inner circles lit by oil lamps hammered to carven posts. Within, at the center, was the Princess Nastoya, girded in a native costume of leather and grass, made all the more effective by a length of striped purple and white toweling she must have bargained from some traveler or other. She stood, distracted and breathing heavily, leaning on stout walking sticks. Around her, sarsen stones like gapped teeth resembled a stone cage through which she could hardly pass, given her bulk. The guests joined the hosts in eating, drinking, and smoking on a pipe with a bowl carved like a crow's head. Crows ranged all around, on the tops of the sarsens, 20, 30, 40. Elfie's head spun. The moon rose, the plain at night, invisible from the secret garden of the green maze, wheeled about like a child's top. She could almost hear the spinning. The Scrow elders chanted in a drone. When the drone died out, the Princess Nastoya raised her head. The huge wattles of old flesh beneath her small chin wobbled. Her toweling fell to the ground. She was naked and old and strong. What had seemed like boredom was revealed as patience, memory, control. She shook the very hair off her head, and it uncoiled down her back and disappeared. Her feet moved massively, as if seeking the best purchase, like columns, like pillars of stone. She dropped her arms forward, and her back was a dome. Still her head was up, her eyes the brighter, her nose working mightily. She was an elephant. An elephant goddess, Elfie thought, her mind recoiling in terror and delight. But the Princess Nastoya said, "No." She spoke through the Rafiki still. He had obviously seen this before, though with the alcohol he stuttered and had to search for words. One by one she asked the intentions of the travelers. "Money and commerce," said Pinchweed, shocked into honesty. "Money and commerce and pillage and plunder, at whatever cost." "A place to die where I can rest, and my spirit go abroad," ventured Igo. "Safety and movement out of harm's way," said Otzi spunkily, by which it was clear she meant out of men's way. The Rafiki indicated that Elfie's own answer was still needed. In the presence of such an animal, Elfie could not stay aloof. So she spoke it as best as she could. "To retire from the world after making sure of the safety of the survivors of my lover. To face his widow, Sarima, in guilt and responsibility. And then to remove myself from the darkening world." The elephant told the others, except the Rafiki, to leave. The elephant raised her trunk and sniffed the wind. Her roomy old eyes blinked slowly, and her ears moved back and forth, raking the air for nuance. She pissed hugely in a steaming flow, with dignity and nonchalance, eyes firmly latched on Elphaba. Through the Rafiki, the elephant then said, "Daughter of the dragon, I too am under a spell. I know how it may be broken, but I choose to live as a changeling. An elephant is a hunted thing in these times. The Scrow approve of me. They have worshipped elephants from the time before language, the time before history began. They know I am not a goddess. They know I am a beast who chooses magical incarceration as a human over the dangerous liberty of my own powerful form. When the times are a crucible, when the air is full of crisis," she said, Those who are the most themselves are the victims. Elfie could only look. She could not speak. But the choice to save yourself can itself be deadly, said the Princess Nastoya. Elfie nodded, looked away, looked back. I will give you 3 crows as your familiars, said the princess. You are in hiding as a witch now. That is your guise. She spoke a word to the crows, and 3 mangy, evil-looking things came and waited nearby. A witch? Elphaba said. What her father would think. Hiding from what? We have the same enemy, replied the princess. We are both at risk. If you need help, send the crows. If I am still alive, as an old matriarch monarch, or as a free elephant, I'll come to your aid. Why? Asked Elfie. Because no retreat from the world can mask what is in your face, she answered. The princess said more. It had been years, more than a decade, since Elfie had been able to talk to an animal. Who, Elfie asked the princess, had enchanted her. But the Princess Nastoya wouldn't say. In part as self-protection, for the death of the enchanter could sometimes mean the revocation of binding spells, and her curse was her safety. "But is life worth living in the wrong form?" said Elfie. "The interior doesn't change," she answered, "except by self-involvement, of which be not afraid, and also beware." "I have no interior," said Elphaba. "Something told those bees to kill the cook," said the Princess Nastoya, with a glitter in her eye. Elphaba felt herself go pale. "I didn't," she said. "No, it couldn't have been me. And how do you know?" "You did, on some level. You are a strong woman. And I can hear bees, you know. My ears are keen." "I would like to stay here with you," said Elphaba. "Life has been very hard. If you can hear me when I cannot hear myself, something the superior Mont could never do, you could help me do no harm in this world. That's all I want, to do no harm." "By your own admission, you have a job to do," said the princess. She curled her trunk around Elphaba's face, feeling its contours and truths. "Go and do it." "May I return to you?" asked Elfie. But the princess wouldn't answer. She was tiring. She was an old, old thing, even for an elephant. Her trunk went back and forth like a pendulum on a clock. Then the great nose hand came forward and set itself with wonderful weight and precision on Elphaba's shoulders and curled a bit around her neck. "Listen to me, sister," she said. "Remember this. Nothing is written in the stars. Not these stars nor any others. No one controls your destiny." Elphaba could not answer, so shocked was she at the touch. She backed away when dismissed, her mind all but out of her. Then the return on camels across the shuddering colors of night grass, hypnotic, vague, and distressing. Yet there was blessing in this night. Elphaba had forgotten blessing, too, like so much else. They left the Skrow encampment and the Princess Nastoya behind. The grass trail train moved in a circle north now, a wide arch. Igo died and was buried in a sandy mound. give his spirit movement and flight, said Elfi at the ceremony. The Rafiki admitted later that he had thought one of the guests of the command meeting with the Princess Nastoya was to be sacrificed in a ritual slaughter. It had happened before. The princess, though coping with her dilemma, was not above a sense of revenge. It was the honesty of Pinchweed that saved him, as he was the obvious choice. Or perhaps Igo wore the prospect of his death closer to the surface than humans could see, and the elephant took pity. The crows were annoying. They pestered the bees, shat all over the wagon, teased Killijoy. The Glicken, Rerene, stopped at a well, met her isolated widower husband-to-be, and left the grass-trail train. The toothless new husband already had 6 motherless children, and they took to Rerene like orphan ducklings behind a farm dog. There were only 10 travelers left. "Now we're entering Arjiki tribal lands," said the Rafiki. The first Arjiki band approached a few days later. They wore nothing so splendid as what Fiyero had worn, in the way of blue markings. These were nomads, shepherds, rounding up the sheep from the western foothills of the Great Kells for their annual counting, and, it seemed, sailed to the east. Still, just the handsome look of them ripped Elfie's heart into pieces. Their wildness, their otherness. "This may be a punishment to the hour of my death," she thought. The grass-trail train, by now, was down to only 2 wagons. In one, the Rafiki, Otzi, Lear the boy, Pinchweed the entrepreneur, and a Gilliconese mechanic named Kaup. In the other, Elfi herself and the bees, the crows, and Killijoy. Already she had, it seemed, been accepted as a witch. It was not an entirely unlikable disguise. Kiamo Ko was just a week away. The grass trail train turned eastward into the steel-gray passes of the steep Great Kells. Winter was almost here, and the last travelers were grateful that the snows had held off. Otzi intended to stop the winter in an Arjiki camp some 20 miles on. In the spring, she would head back to the Emerald City, making the northern route through Ugabu and the Pertha Hills of Gilliken. Elfi thought of sending a note to Glinda, if, after all these years, she was still there. But being unable to decide yes, she decided no. "Tomorrow," said Otzi, "we'll see Kiamo Ko, the mountain stronghold of the ruling clan of the Arjikis. Are you ready, Sister Elfi?" She was teasing, and Elfi didn't like it. "I am no longer a sister, I am a witch," she said, and tried to think poisonous thoughts at Otzi. But Otzi was a stronger person than the cook, apparently, for she just laughed and went on her way. The grass trail train stopped on the side of a small tarn. The others said its water was refreshing, though icy cold. Elfi didn't know or care about that. But in the middle was an island, a tiny thing, the size of a mattress, sprouting one leafless tree like an umbrella that has lost its fabric. Before Elphaba could quite make it out, the evening light came early at this time of year, and even earlier in the mountains. Killijoy had plunged feverishly into the water, and splashed and swum his way to the island, intent on some small movement or interesting scent he had picked up. He ferreted in the sedge, and then clamped his teeth, the most wolf-like of his features, gently around the skull of a small beast in the grass. Elfi couldn't see, but it looked like a baby. Otzi screamed, Lear quivered like a blob of jelly. Killijoy released his grip, but only to get a further hold. He was drooling over the scalp of the thing he had caught. There was no way to get through the water. That would be death. But her feet went out anyway. They hit the water hard. The water hit hard back. The water turned to ice as she ran, foot by foot of ice under foot by foot of hurry. A silvering plate formed instantly, cantilevering forward, making a cold, safe bridge to the island. Where Killijoy could be scolded, and the baby saved, though she hadn't dared hope she could be in time. She pried Killijoy's jaws apart and scooped up the thing. It shivered in terror and the cold. Its bright black eyes were alert and watching, ready to upbraid or condemn or love, same as any capable adult thing. The others were surprised to see it, as surprised as they'd been to see the ice form, perhaps by some magic spell left on the tarn from some passing wizard or witch. It was a small monkey, of the variety called the snow monkey. A baby abandoned by its mother and its tribe, or maybe separated by accident. It didn't think much of Killijoy, but it liked the warmth of the wagon. They pitched their camp halfway up the perilous slope to Kiamo Cove. The castle rose in steep black angles out of black rock. Elfie could see it perched above them, like an eagle with folded wings. Its conical-roofed towers, its battlements and bartizans, its portcullis and arrow-slit windows, they all belied its original intention as the head of a waterworks. Below it wound a powerful tributary of the Vincus River, on which the Ozma Regent once had meant to build a dam and channel water into the center of Oz, back when the droughts were their most threatening. Fiero's father had taken this stronghold by siege and storm, and made it the seat of the Arjiki princes before dying and leaving the clan leadership to his only son, if Elphaba remembered rightly. The small luggage was packed, the bees hummed, their melodies ever more amusing as she listened week by week. Killijoy was still sulking over being denied the kill. The crows sensed that a change was coming and wouldn't eat dinner. The monkey, who was called Chistery because of the sound he made, chittered and chattered now that he was warm and safe. Around the campfire, goodbyes were spoken, a few toasts, even a few regrets. The sky was blacker than it had been before. Perhaps it was the contrast of the whiteness of snowy peaks all around. Lear showed up with a parcel of clothing and some sort of musical instrument and said goodbyes, too. "Oh, so you're stopping here, are you?" said Elfie. "Yes," he said, "with you." With the crows, the monkey, with the bees, with the dog, and with the witch, she said, with me. "Where else can I go?" he asked. "I'm sure I don't know," she answered. "I can take care of the dog," he said calmly. "I can collect the honey for you." "It makes no difference to me," she said. "All right," he said. And so Lear prepared to enter his father's house. The Jasper Gates of Kiamo Cove. "Sarima," said her youngest sister, "wake up, nap time's over. We have a house guest at supper, and I need to know if we have to kill a hen. There are so few left, and what we give the traveler, we miss all winter in eggs. What do you think?" The Dowager Princess of the Arjikis groaned. "Details, details," she said. "Can't I train you to figure out anything for yourself?" "Very well," snapped the sister. "I shall decide, and then you can go without your morning egg when we're one short." "Oh, Six, don't mind me," said Sarima. "It's just that I'm scarcely awake. Who is it? Some patriarch with bad breath who plans to bore us with tales of the hunting he did 50 years ago?" Why do we allow it? It's a woman, more or less, said Six. Now that's uncalled for, said Sarima, sitting up. We are none of us the blushing nymphs we once were, Six. From across the room, she saw herself reflected in the wardrobe glass, pale as milk pudding, her still pretty face nestled in the puddles of fat that fell according to the laws of gravity. Just because you're the youngest, Six, and can still locate your waist, there's no need to be unkind. Six pouted. Well, it's just a woman, then, so chicken or no. Tell me now, so Four can hack off its head and get to plucking, or we won't eat before midnight. We'll have fruit and cheese and bread and fish. Is there fish in the fish well, I suppose? Yes, there was. Six turned to go, but remembered to say, I brought you a glass of sweet tea. It's there on your vanity. Bless you. Now tell me, without sarcasm, if you please, what's our guest like, really? Green as sin, thin and crooked, older than any of us, dressed in black like an old Mont, but not all that old. I guess about, 30, 32. She wouldn't give her name. Green? How divine, said Sarima. Divine isn't the word that comes to mind, said Six. You don't mean green with jealousy. You mean actually green? Maybe it's from jealousy. I could not say. But she is surely green. Genuine grass green. Oh, la. Well, I'll wear white tonight so as not to clash. Is she alone? She came in with the caravan we saw down in the valley yesterday. She stopped here with a little company of beasts, a wolf dog, a hive of bees, a youth, some crows, and a baby monkey. What'll she do with all of them in the mountains in winter? Ask her yourself, Six wrinkled her nose. She made me shudder. Half-set gelatin makes you shudder. When's dinner tonight? 7 chimes and a half. She turns my stomach. Six left, having run out of expressions of disgust, and Sarima had her tea in bed until her bladder complained. Six had banked up the fire and drawn the curtains, but Sarima pulled them back to look down into the courtyard. Kiamo Ko boasted corner turrets and towers, built on massive circular salients thrusting upward from the stone of the mountain itself. After the Arjiki clan had wrested the building from the Waterworks Commission, they had added toothy crenellations for defense. Despite the reworkings, the plan of the house was still simple. It was built in the general shape of a U, a central hall with two long, narrow wings thrusting forward around a steeply pitched yard. When it rained, the water churned over the cobbles and slipped out under the carved gates of iron oak and jasper panels, past the sickly cluster of village houses nestled up against the castle's outside walls. At this hour, the courtyard was charcoal gray. Cold and filthy, with scraps of hay and bits of leaf flying in the wind. There was a light in the old cobbler's shed, and smoke spinning from the chimney that badly wanted repointing, like everything else in this decaying manse. Sarima was glad the guest hadn't been shown into the house proper. As Dowager Princess of the Arjikis, she enjoyed the privilege of welcoming a traveller into the private chambers of Kiamo Ko. After bathing, she dressed in a white shift with white piping and put on the beautiful torque that had arrived like a message from the other land from her dear departed husband several months after the incident. Out of habit, Sarima shed a few tears, admiring herself within the flat embrace of its jeweled, segmented collar. If it was too dressy for this itinerant, Sarima could always drape a napkin over it. But she would still know it was there. even before her tears had dried. She was humming, looking forward to the novelty of a guest. She peeped in on the children before going down. They were jumpy. Strangers always did that to them. Irgy and Manik, 12 and 11, were almost old enough to want to bust out of this nest of venomous doves. Irgy was soft and cried a lot, but Manik was a little bantam. Always had been. If she let them go off to the grasslands with the clan in the summer migration, they both might have their throats slit. There were too many clansmen to claim leadership for themselves or their sons, so Sarima had kept her boys near. Her daughter, Noor, long-legged and thumb-sucking at 9 years old, still needed a lap to crawl into before going to sleep. Dressed for the meal, Sarima was inclined to forbid it, but relented. Noor had a delicate lisp, and she said, "Wunning in the wain," for running in the rain. She befriended stones and candles and blades of grass that grew against all logic in the cracks of the coping stones around the windows. She sighed and rubbed her face against the torque and said, "There's a boy, too, Mama. We played with him in the mill yard." "What's he like? Is he green, too?" "Nah, he's all right. He's a big baby, fat and strong, and Manik was throwing stones at him to see how far they would bounce off him. He let him do it. Maybe if you're so fat it doesn't hurt."
"I doubt it. What's his name?"
"Weir. Isn't that a queer name?"
"It sounds foreign. And his mother?"
"I don't know her name, and I don't think she's his mother. He wouldn't say when we asked. Irgy said he must be a bastard. Weir said he didn't care. He's nice."
She moved her right thumb to her mouth, and with her left hand felt the cloth of Sarima's gown just below the torque, until she found a nipple, and she ran her thumb over it lovingly, as if it were a small pet.
"Manik made him pull down his trousers, so we could make sure his thing wasn't green."
Sarima disapproved, on the grounds of hospitality, if nothing else, but was compelled to ask, "And what did you see?"
"Oh, well, you know."
Noor turned her head into her mother's neck, and then sneezed from the powder with which Sarima kept her chins from chafing.
"Stupid-looking boy's thing. Smaller than Manik and Irgy, but not green. I was so bored, I didn't look much."
"Neither would I. That was very rude."
"I didn't make him do it. Manik did."
"Well, no more of that. Now let's have a story before sleeping. I've got to go down soon, so a short one. What do you want to hear, my little one?"
"I want to hear the story of the witch and the fox babies."
With less drama than usual, Sarima rattled through the tale of how the three fox babies were kidnapped and caged and fed to fatness in preparation for a cheese and foxling casserole, and how the witch went to get fire from the sun to cook them. But when the witch came back to her cave, exhausted and in possession of Father Flame, the foxlings outwitted her by singing a lullaby to make her sleep. When the witch's arm fell, the flame from the sun burned the door off the cage, and out the foxlings ran. Then they howled down Old Mother Moon to come and stand as an unmovable door in the entrance of the cave. Sarima ended with the traditional back and forth. And there the wicked old witch stayed for a good long time.
"Did she ever come out?"
asked Noor, doing her line from an almost hypnagogic state.
"Not yet,"
said Sarima, kissing and biting her daughter on the wrist, which made them both giggle, and then lights out.
The stairs from Sarima's private apartment ran without railings down into the castle keep, hugging first one wall and then, after the corner, another. She descended the first flight, full of grace and self-possession, her white skirts billowing, her torque a yoke of soft colors and precious metals, her face a careful composition of welcome. At the landing she saw the traveler sitting on a bench in an alcove, looking up at her. She made it down the second flight to the flagstoned level, aware of the cynicism that seethed beneath her loyal remembrance of Fiyero, aware of her overbite, of her lost prettiness, of her weight, of the silliness of being the doyen over nothing but irritating children and backbiting younger sisters, of the thin pretense of authority that scarcely masked her fear of the present, the future, and even the past. "How do you do?" she managed. "You are Sarima," said the woman, standing, her stalactite of chin thrust forward like a rotted Swede. "Likely to be," she said, glad of the torque. It seemed like a shield now, to protect her heart from being punctured by that chin. "Greetings to you, my friend. Yes, I am Sarima, mistress of Kiamo Ko. Where do you come from, and how are you called?" "I come from the back of the wind," said the woman, "and I have given up my name so often I don't like to bring it out again for you." "Well, you are welcome here," said Sarima, as smoothly as she could. "But if we have nothing else to call you by, you will have to be auntie. Will you come in to dine? We'll be serving out soon." "I won't eat until we speak," said the guest. "Not under your roof in false pretenses for one night. I'd rather lie at the bottom of a lake. Sarima, I know who you are. I went to school with your husband. I've known about you for a dozen years or so." "Of course," said Sarima then, things clicking. The old treasured details of her husband's life came rushing up. "Of course Fiyero talked of you, and of your sister Nessie, right? Nessa Rose. And of the glamorous Glinda, with whom I think he was a little in love. And the playful inverted boys, and Averick, and solid old Bach. I had wondered if that happy time of his life was always to be self-contained, always his and never mine. You are good to have come to call. I should have liked a season or two at Shiz, but I didn't have the brains, I fear, nor my family the money. I would have remembered you in a minute. Well, the color of your skin, there's nothing like it, is there? Or am I too provincial?" "No, it's unique," said the guest. "Before we say 10 sentences of polite nonsense to each other, I have to tell you something, Sarima. I think I was the cause of Fiyero's death." "Well, you're not the only one," interrupted Sarima. "It's a national pastime out here, blaming oneself for the death of a prince. An opportunity for public grieving and atonement, which I secretly believe people enjoy just a little bit." The guest twisted her fingers, as if to pry open a space for herself in Sarima's opinions. "I can tell you how. I want to tell you. Not unless I want to hear it, which is my prerogative. This is my house, and I choose to hear what I want." "You must hear it, so that I can be forgiven," said the woman, turning her shoulders this way and that, almost as if she were a beast of burden, with an invisible yoke on her. Sarima did not like to be ambushed in her own home. Time enough to consider these sudden implications, when she felt up to it, and not until. She reminded herself that she was in charge, and thus she could afford to be kind. "If I remember rightly," said Sarima, her mind was racing with memory, "you're the one—Fiyero talked of you, of course, Elphaba, that's it. You're the one who didn't believe in the soul.
I remember that much.
So what's to forgive, dearie? I know you're travel-weary. It's impossible to get here without being travel-weary. And you need a good hot meal and a few nights of sleep, and we'll chat some morning next week.
Sarima linked her arm with Elphaba's.
But I'll preserve your name from them, if you like, said Sarima.
She walked Elphaba through the tall, warped oak doors into the dining hall and called,
Look who's here! Auntie Guest!
The sisters were standing beside their chairs, hungry and curious and impatient. Four had the ladle in the tureen, stirring. Six had dressed in a hostel puce. Two and three, the twins, looked piously at their prayer cards. Five was smoking and blowing concentric rings toward the platter of yellow eyeless fish they had dragged up from the underground lake.
"Sisters, rejoice! An old friend of Fiero's has come to share fond memories and enliven our lives. Welcome her as you do me."
Perhaps an unfortunate choice of words, as the sisters all resented and despised Sarima.
Why had she married someone who would die so early and condemn them not just to spinsterhood, but to deprivation and denial?
Elphaba didn't speak through the entire meal, or look up from her plate. She devoured the fish, though, and the cheese and the fruit. Sarima deduced from her eating habits that she had lived under a rule of silence at meals, and wasn't surprised later to hear about the Monterey. They took a glass of precious sherry in the music room, and Six entertained them with a wobbling nocturne. The guest looked miserable, which made the sisters happy. Sarima sighed. The one thing that could be said about the guest was this. She was older than Sarima. Perhaps for the short while of her stay, Elphaba would come out of that sulk and lend an ear to hear how troubling and trying Sarima's life was. It would be nice to chat with someone not in the family. A week passed before Sarima said to Three,
"Please tell our Auntie Guest that I'd like to see her tomorrow for elevenses in the solar."
Sarima thought that Elphaba had had enough time now to get the measure of things. The suffering green woman was in some sort of slow-motion thrall or fit. She moved jerkily, stalking about the courtyard, or stamping in to meals, as if trying to poke holes in the flooring with her heels. Her elbows were always bent at right angles, and her hands clenched and unclenched themselves. Sarima felt stronger than ever, which wasn't very. It did her some good to have a contemporary around, however thwarted she might be. The sisters disapproved of Sarima's cordiality, but the higher mountain passes were already closed for the winter, and you just couldn't send a stranger packing into the treacherous valleys. The sisters conferred in their parlor as they busied themselves knitting hateful gray potholders for the undeserving poor at Lurleenmas. "She's sick," they said. "She's inert, unfinished, even more than they were," was the unspoken corollary, an immensely gratifying notion.
"She's damned."
"And is that fat balloon of a boy her son, or a child slave, or is he one of her familiars?" Behind Sarima's back, they called the woman living in the cobble shed Auntie Witch, echoing the old legends of Cambresia, which were viler and more persistent in the Kells than elsewhere in Oz. It was Manic, Sarima's middle child, who was the most curious. One morning, as the boys all stood on a battlement, pissing over the side, a game poor Noor had to pretend no interest in, Manic said,
"What if we peed on Auntie? Would she scream?"
"'She'd turn you into a toad,' said Lear.
"'No, I mean, would it hurt her? "'She looks like water gives her the aches and shakes. "'Does she even drink it, or does it make her insides hurt?'
"'Lear, not an especially observant child, said, "'I think she doesn't drink it. "'Sometimes she washes things, but she uses sticks and brushes. "'We better not pee on her.'
"'And what does she do with all those bees and the monkey? "'Are they magic?'
"'Yeah,' said Lear.
"'What kind of magic?'
"'I don't know.' They stepped away from the dizzying drop, and Noor came running up.
"'I have a magic straw,' she said, holding up a brown bristle. "'From the witch's broom.'
"'Is the broom magic?' said Manik to Lear.
"'Yes, it can sweep the floor real fast. "'Can it talk? Is it enchanted? What does it say?'
They got more interested, and Lear bloomed and blushed under their curiosity.
"'I can't tell. It's a secret.'
"'Is it still a secret if we push you off the tower?' Lear considered.
"'What do you mean?'
"'Will you tell us, or we'll do it?'
"'Don't push me off the tower, you oafs.' "'If the broom is magic, it'll come flying by and save you. "'Besides, you're so fat, you'd probably bounce.'
"'Irgi and Noor laughed at that, despite themselves. "'It made a very funny picture in their minds.
"'We only want to know what secrets the broom says to you,' said Manik with a big smile. "'So tell us, or we'll push you off.'
"'You're not being nice. He's company,' said Noor.
"'Come on. Let's go find some mice in the pantry and make friends.' "'In a minute. Let's push Lear off the roof first.
"'No,' said Noor, beginning to cry. "'You boys are so mean. Are you sure that broom is magic, Weir?'
But Lear by now didn't want to say any more.
Manik tossed a pebble off the roof, and it seemed a very long time before the ping of impact. Lear's face had, in a matter of moments, developed deep black pockets under the eyes. He held his hands down by his sides, like a traitor at a court-martial.
"'The witch'll be so mad at you that she will hate you,' Lear said. "'I don't think so,' said Manik, taking a step forward. "'She won't care. She likes the monkey more than she likes you. She won't even notice if you're dead.' Lear gasped for air. Although he had just peed, the front of his baggy trousers turned dark with wet.
"'Look, Irgi,' said Manik, and his older brother looked.
"'He's not even very good at being alive, is he?' "'It's not like it would be much of a loss. "'Come on, Lear. "'Tell me. "'What did the damned broom say to you?'
"'Lear's upper torso was going in and out like a bellows. "'He whispered,
"'The broom told me that you're all going to die.'
"'Oh, is that all?' said Manik. "'We already knew that.' "'Everybody dies. We knew that already.'
"'You did?' said Lear, who hadn't.
"'Come on,' Irgi said. "'Come on, let's catch some mice in the pantry, and we can cut off their tails and use Noor's magic straw to prick their eyes.'
"'No!' said Noor.
But Irgi had swiped the straw from her. Manik and Irgi went clattering, loose-limbed as marionettes, along the parapet and down the stairs. With a huge, aggrieved sigh, Lear composed himself and adjusted his clothes and followed them like a condemned dwarf laborer in the emerald mines. Noor stayed behind,
her arms folded defiantly, her chin working with frustration. Then she spit over the edge and felt better, and chased after the boys. At mid-morning, Six showed the guest into the solar. With a smirk behind Auntie's back, she deposited a tray of cruel little biscuits, hard as slate, on a table covered with a carpet gone brown and patternless. Sarima, having made her way through what she could of her daily spiritual ablutions, felt ready. "You've been here a week, and it's likely to be longer," said Sarima, allowing Six to pour out some gall-root coffee before dismissing her. "The trail north is snowed in by now, and there's not a safe haven between here and the plains. The winters are hard in the mountains, and while we can make do with our stores and our own company, we treasure a change. Milk? I do not know exactly what you had intended, once you had visited us sufficiently, I mean. There are rumors of caves in these kells," Elphaba said, almost more to herself than to Sarima. "I lived for some years at the cloister of St. Glinda in the Shale Shallows, outside of the Emerald City. Dignitaries would visit, and while we were often under a vow of silence, nonetheless, people would talk of what they knew. Monastic cells. I had thought, when I was done here, that I might take myself to a cave and set up housekeeping," said Sarima, as if this were as usual as marrying and bearing babies. "Some do it, I know. There's an old hermit on the western slope of Broken Bottle. That's a peak nearby. They say he's been there for some years and has reverted to a more primitive moment of nature. Of his nature, I mean." "A life without words," Elfie said, looking in her coffee and not drinking it. "They say this hermit has forgotten about personal hygiene," said Sarima, "which, given how the boys smell when they go unwashed for a couple of weeks, strikes me as nature's defense against marauding beasts." "I didn't expect to be here for a long time," Elfie said, twisting her head on her neck like a parrot and looking at Sarima in an odd way. Oh, beware, thought Sarima carefully, though she tended to like this guest. Beware, she's taking the direction of the discussion into her own hands. This won't do. But the guest went on. "I had thought that I would have a night or two, maybe three, and could find myself a hidey-hole before winter set in. I was working on the wrong calendar. I was thinking of how and when winter came to Shiz and the Emerald City. But you're 6 weeks ahead here." "Ahead in the autumn, and behind in the spring, alas," said Sarima. She took her feet off her hassock and placed them on the floor flatly, to indicate seriousness. "Now, my new friend, there are some things I need to say to you." "I have things, too," Elfie said, but Sarima went on this time. "You will think me an unpolished person, and you are right, of course. Oh, when I was selected to be a child bride, a good governess was hired from Gillikin to teach me and my sisters how to use verbs and pronouns and salad forks. And lately I have begun to master reading. But most of what I picked up about polite behavior was from what Fiero was good enough to instruct me in when he returned from his education. No doubt I make social mistakes. You have every right to snigger behind my back." "I am not given to sniggering," snapped Elphaba. "As it may be. But I still have opinions, and I'm observant, even if unschooled. Despite my sheltered life, married at the age of 7, as you may know, raised and reared behind castle curtain walls, I trust my own sense of things, and won't be dissuaded. So let me continue," she said, as Elphaba tried to interrupt. "There is plenty of time, and the sun is nice in here, isn't it? My little hideaway. It seems to me that you have come here to, shall we say, relieve yourself of some sad business or other. You have the look about you. Don't be startled, my dear. If there's a look I do recognize, it's the look of someone carrying a burden. Remember, I listen to my sisters year in and year out as they graciously share with me all the ways they hate me and why." She smiled, amused at her own wit. "You want to throw down your burden? Throw it down at my feet or across my shoulders. You want, perhaps, to weep a little, to say goodbye, and then to leave. And when you leave here, you will walk right out of the world." "I will do no such thing," said Elfie. "You will, indeed, even if you don't know it. You will have nothing left to tie you to the world. But I know my own limits, Auntie Guest, and I know what you're here for. You told me. You told me in the hall. You said you felt you were responsible for Fiero's death." "I don't. Just don't. This is my home. I am a nominal dowager princess of Duckshit, but I have a right to hear, and I have a right not to hear, even to make a traveler feel better. I don't. But I don't want to burden you, Sarima. I want to unburden you with the truth, if you permit me. You are the larger, the lighter. Forgiveness blesses the donor as well as the receiver." "I'll overlook that remark about my being the larger," said Sarima. "But I still have the right to choose, and I think you wish me ill. You wish me ill, and you don't even know it. You want to punish me for something, maybe for not being a good enough wife to Fiero. You wish me ill, and you fool yourself to think it's some therapeutic course of tablets." "Do you know how he died, at least?" said Elphaba. "I know it was a violent action. I know his body was never found. I know it was in a little love nest," said Sarima, for a minute losing her resolve. "I don't care to know who it was exactly, but I have heard enough about that vile Sir Chuffrey to have my strong opinion." "Sir Chuffrey?" "I said no. I said no more. Now I have an offer to make of you, Auntie, if you will have it. You and the boy may move into the southeast tower if you like. There are a couple of big round rooms with high ceilings and good light, and you'll be out of that drafty cobble shed and warmer. You'll have your own staircase to come and go into the main hall, and you won't bother the girls and they won't trouble you. You can't stay in that cobble shed all winter. The boy has been looking pale and blubbery. I think he's always cold. You're there on the condition, I'm afraid, that you accept my firmest word on these matters. I don't care to discuss my husband or the affairs of his death with you." Elphaba looked horror-struck and beaten. "I have no choice but to accept," she said, "at least for the time being. But I warn you, I intend to befriend you so thoroughly that you will change your mind. And I do think you need to hear things. You need to talk about them as I do. And I can't leave into the wilderness until I have your solemn promise of—" "Enough," said Sarima. "Call the porter from the gatehouse and have him bring your luggage to the tower. Come, I'll show you. You haven't touched your coffee." She stood. For an awkward moment, there was respect and suspicion in equal measure, simmering on the carpet like the dust in the sunbeams. "Come," Sarima said more softly. "At the very least, you need to be warm. You must be able to say that much of us country mice here at Kiamo Ko."
As far as Elphaba was concerned, it was a witch's room, and she revelled in it. Like all good witches' rooms in children's stories, it was a room with bowed walls, following the essential form of a tower. It had one broad window that, since it faced east, away from the wind, could be unbarred and opened without blowing everyone and everything out into the snowy valleys. Beyond, the great kells were a rank of sentinels, purple-black when the winter sun rose over them, draining into blue-white screens as the sun moved overhead, and going golden and ruddy in the late afternoon. There were sometimes rumbling collapses of ice and scree. The winter gripped the house. Elphaba learned soon enough to stay put, unless she was sure another room had a warmer fire. And except for Sarima, she didn't care for the other human company the house afforded. Sarima lived in the west wing with the children, the boys Irgi and Manik, the girl Noor. Sarima's five sisters lived in the east wing. They were called numbers 2 through 6, and if they had ever had other names, they had withered away from disuse. By right of their unmarriageability, the sisters claimed the best rooms in the place, although Sarima had the solar. Where Lear curled up to sleep, Elphaba did not know, but he reappeared every morning to change the rags at the bottom of the crow's perch. He brought her cocoa, too. Lurlinmus drew near, and out came some tired decorations, from which the gilt had all but vanished. The children spent a whole day tying baubles and toys to the archways, making the grown-ups bump their heads and curse. Manik and Irgi took a saw, and without permission went beyond the castle walls to claim some boughs of spruce and sprigs of holly. Noor stayed behind, and painted scenes of happy life in the castle, on sheets of paper that she and Lear had found in Auntie Witch's room. Lear said he couldn't draw, so he wandered off and disappeared, perhaps to stay clear of Manik and Irgi. The house fell still, until there was a flurry of copper pans thrown about the kitchen. Noor went running to see, and Lear arrived from some hiding cubby to look too. It was Chistery. The monkey was having a fit, and all the sisters, baking gingerbread, were throwing gobbets of batter at him, trying to knock him off the wheel that hung, noisy with swinging utensils, above the work table. "How'd he get in here?" said Noor. "Get him out. Lear, call him," said Two. But Lear had no more authority over Chistery than they did. The monkey flew to the top of a wardrobe, then to a huge dried-goods canister, and he pulled open a drawer and found a precious store of raisins, which he stuffed in his mouth. Six said, "Go get the ladder from the hall, you two, and bring it here." But when they had, Chistery was back on the wheel, making it whirl and clatter like a roundabout at a carnival. Four put a lump of mashed melon in the bowl. Five and Three took off their aprons, ready to rush him when he came down. Chistery was still eyeing the fruit when the door smacked open against the wall and Elphaba came lolloping in. "All this commotion? How can you hear yourselves think?" she cried, and then took in the sight of Chistery, suddenly abject and remorseful, and of the sisters poised to ensnare him in their flowery aprons. "What the hell is this?" she said. "No need to yell," said Two sulkily, quietly. But they put down their aprons. "I mean, what is this? What is really going on here? You all look like Killyjoy, with blood-lust in your faces. You're white with rage at this poor beast." "I think it's not rage, it's flour," said Five, which made them giggle. "You filthy savages," said Elfie. "Chistery, come here. Come down here, right now." You women deserve to be unmarried, so you don't bring any little savage, creepy children into the world. Don't you ever lay a hand on this monkey, do you hear me? And how did he get out of my room, anyway? I was in the solar with your sister.
Oh, said Noah, remembering. Oh, Auntie, I'm sorry, it was us.
You? She turned and looked at Noor as if for the first time, and Noor didn't like it much. She shrank back against the door of the cold cellar.
"'What were you skulking about in my room for?' said Elfie.
"'Some paper,' said Noor faintly, and in a desperate all-for-nothing gamble said, "'I made some paintings for everybody. Do you want to see? Come here.'
Chistery in her arms, Elphaba followed them into the draughty hall, where the wind under the front door was making the papers flutter against the carved stone. The sisters came too, a safe distance behind. Elfie got very quiet.
"'This is my paper,' she said. "'I didn't say you could use it. Look, it has words on the back.' Do you know what words are?
Of course I do. Do you think I am slow? Responded Noor sassily.
You leave my papers alone, said Elphaba. She and Chistri then flew up the steps, and the door to the tower slammed behind them.
Who wants to help roll out the gingerbread? Said Two, relieved that skulls hadn't been knocked together. "'And this hall looks very pretty, chickadees. "'I'm sure Prinella and Lurline will be impressed tonight.'
"'The children went back into the kitchen "'and made gingerbread people and crows and monkeys and dogs, "'but they couldn't do bees, they were too small. "'When Irgi and Manic came in, "'dumping snowy greens on the slate floor, "'they helped at the gingerbread shapes, too.' But they made naughty shapes that they wouldn't show the younger children, and they kept gobbling up the raw dough and laughing hysterically at it, which made everyone else testy. In the morning the children awoke and ran downstairs to see if Lurline and Prinella had been there. Sure enough, there was a brown wicker basket with a green and gold ribbon on it, a basket and a ribbon that Sarima's children had seen many years in a row. And in it were three small colored boxes, each one with an orange, a puppet, and a small sack of marbles, and a gingerbread mouse.
"'Where's mine?' said Lear.
"'Don't see one with your name on it,' said Irgi. "'Look, Irgi, Manic. Nor. Guess Prinella left it for you at your old house. Where did you used to live?
I don't know, said Lear, and started to cry. Here, you can have the tail of my mouse, just the tail, said Nor kindly. First you have to say, may I please have the tail of your mouse?
"'May I please have the tail of your mouse?' said Lear, though his words were almost unintelligible.
"'And I promise to obey you,'
Lear mumbled on. The exchange was eventually completed. From shame, Lear didn't mention the oversight. Sarima and the sisters never took it in. Elphaba didn't show her face all day. But she sent down a message that Lurlinmas Eve and Lurlinmas always made her ill, and she was taking a few days in solitary comfort, and she wanted to be disturbed neither with meals nor visitors nor noise of any kind. So while Sarima took herself off to her private chapel to remember her dear husband on this holy day, the sisters and the children all sang carols as loudly as they could.
A few weeks later, when the children were having snowball battles and Sarima was concocting some medicinal toddy in the kitchen, Elfie left her room at last and skulked down the stairs and knocked on the door of the sisters' parlor. They didn't like it, but they felt obliged to welcome her. The silver tray with bottles of hard liquor, the precious crystal carried on donkey all the way from Dixie House in Gillikin, the prettiest and red-richest of native carpets on the floor, the luxury of fireplaces at both sides of the room, each blazing merrily. Well, they would have toned it down some had they had any warning. As it was, four hid in the sofa cushions the leather volume from which she had been reading aloud, a racy history of a poor young woman beset by an abundance of handsome suitors. It had been a gift from Fiyero once, the best gift he had ever sent the sisters, also the only one. "Would you like some lemon barley water?" said Six, ever the servant until the day she died, unless by luck everyone else died sooner. "Yes, all right," Elphaba said. "Do take a seat. This seat here, you'll find it most comfy." Elfie didn't look as if she wanted to be comfy, but she sat there anyway, stiff and uneasy in that quilted cocoon of a room. She took the tiniest sip possible from her drink, as if suspecting hellebore. "I suppose I need to apologize for that flurry over Chistery," she said. "I know I am your guest here at Kiamo Co. I just flew off the handle." "Well, you did just that," started Five, but the others said, "Oh, think nothing of it. We all have days like that. In fact, for us it usually happens on the same day. It's been that way for years." "It's very taxing," Elfie said with some effort. "I spent many years under a vow of silence, and I haven't always learned how loud it is permissible to get. Besides that, this is a foreign culture in a way." "We Arjikis have always been proud of being able to speak to any other citizen in Oz," said Two. "We are as equally at home with the ragged vagabond Skro to our south as with the elite in the Emerald City to our east." Not that they'd ever been out of the Vincus. "A little nibble?" said Three, bringing out a tin of marzipan fruits. "No," Elfie said, "but I wonder what you could tell me of your sister's particular sadness." They sat poised, tempted, and suspicious. "I enjoy my chats with her in the solar," said Elfie, "but whenever the talk gets around to her departed husband, whom, as you may realize, I myself knew, she is unwilling to discuss a thing." "Oh, well, it was so sad," said Two. "A tragedy," said Three. "For her," said Four. "For us," said Five. "Auntie Guest, take a little orange liqueur in your lemon barley," said Six. "It comes from the balmy slopes of the Lesser Kells, and is quite a luxury." "Well, just a drop," said Elfie, but didn't sip it. She put her elbows on her knees and leaned forward and said, "Please tell me how she learned of Fiero's death." There was a silence. The sisters avoided casting glances at one another, busying themselves with the pleats of their skirts. After a pause, it was Two who said, "That sad day, it stings in the memory still." The others adjusted themselves in their seats, turning slightly toward her. Elphaba blinked twice, looking like one of her own crows. Two told the tale, without sentiment or drama. One of Fiyero's business colleagues, an Arjiki trader, had come through the mountain pass at the first spring thaw, on the back of a mountain skark. He asked to meet with Sarima,
and insisted her sisters be around to support her at his woeful news. He told them how, on Lerlinmas, he had received at his club an anonymous message that Fiero had been murdered. There was an address in a disreputable area, not even a residential neighborhood. The clansmen hired a couple of brutes and broke down the door of the warehouse. Inside was a small apartment hidden upstairs, a place of assignation, obviously. The clansmen reported this without flinching, perhaps as a power-mongering maneuver. There was evidence of struggle and massive quantities of blood, so thick in places that it was still tacky. The body had been removed, and it was never recovered. Elphaba only nodded grimly at this recounting. "For a year," continued Two, "our dear, distraught Sarima refused to believe he was really dead. We would not have been surprised at a ransom note. But by the following Lerlinmas, when no further word about it had arrived, we had to accept the inevitable. Besides, the clan had gone on as long as it could with an ad hoc collaborative leadership. They demanded a single chief. And one was put forward, and he served well. When Irji comes of age, he may claim the rights of progenitorship, if he's bold enough. He is not yet bold at all. Manic is the more obvious candidate, but he's only second in line." "And what does Sarima believe happened?" said Elfie. "And you, all of you." Now that the grimmest part of the story had been told, the other sisters felt they could chime in. It emerged that Sarima had for some years suspected Fiero of having an affair with an old college chum named Glinda, a Gilliconese girl of legendary beauty. "Legendary?" Elfie said. "He told us all how charming she was, how self-effacing, what grace and sparkle." "Is it all that likely he'd gush on and on about a woman he was committing adultery with?" "Men," said Two, "are, as we all know, both cruel and cunning. What better ruse than to admit fervently and often that he admired her? Sarima had no grounds on which to accuse him of slyness and deception. He never stopped being attentive to her." "In his cold, morose, withdrawn, embittered fashion," interjected Three. "Hardly the thing one reads about in novels," said Four. "If one read novels," said Five. "Which we don't," said Six, closing her lips over a marzipan pear. "And so Sarima believes her husband was carrying on with this dazzler," said Two. "You must have known her. Didn't you go to Shiz?" "I knew her a bit," Elfie said, her mouth forgetting to shut itself. She was having a hard time keeping up with the multiple narrators. "I haven't seen her in years." "And it is clear in Sarima's mind what happened," said Two. "Glinda was, for all I know, still is, married to a wealthy older gentleman named Sir Chuffrey. He must have suspected something and had her followed, and found out what was going on. Then he had some thugs kill the bastard. I mean, poor Fiero. Doesn't that make sense?" "It's entirely plausible," Elfie said slowly. "But is there any proof?" "No proof at all," said Four. "If there were, family honor would have required a retributive murder of Sir Chuffrey. But he may still be in robust good health. No, it's only a theory, but it's what Sarima believes." "Clings to," said Six. "And why not?" said Five. "It's her prerogative," said Three. "Everything's her prerogative," said Two sadly. "Besides, think of it. If your husband were murdered, wouldn't it be easier to bear if you thought he deserved it, even just a little?" "No," Elfie said, "I don't think it would." Neither do we, admitted Two. But we think that's what she thinks.
And you? Elfie asked, studying the pattern in the carpet, the blood-red lozenges, the thorny margins, the beasts and acanthus leaves and rose medallions. What do you think?
We hardly can be expected to subscribe to a unanimous opinion, said Two. But she barreled ahead anyway. It seems reasonable to suppose that, unbeknownst to us, Fiyero had gotten involved in some political enterprise in the Emerald City.
A stay that was to be a month became four, said Four.
Had he political sensibilities? Said Elphaba.
He was the prince of the Arjikis, Five reminded them all. He had connections, responsibilities, allegiances. Who of us could guess at them? It was his duty to have opinions on things we shouldn't need to know about.
Was he sympathetic to the wizard? Said Elfie.
Are you saying was he involved in any of those campaigns, those pogroms? First the Quadlings, then the animals, said Three. You look surprised that we should know about these things. Do you think we're so very removed from the rest of Oz?
We are removed, said Two, but we listen to talk. We like to feed travelers when they come to stop. We know life can be rotten out there.
The wizard is a despot, said Four.
Our home is our castle, said Five at the same time. Some removal from all this is healthy. We retain our moral fiber, unsullied. They all smirked simultaneously.
But do you think Fiyero had an opinion about the wizard? Elphaba asked again, pressing with some urgency.
He kept his own counsel, snapped Two. For the sake of sweet Lurline, dear auntie, he was a prince and a man, and we were nothing but his younger, dependent sisters-in-law. Do you think he would confide in us? He could have been a high-level crony of the wizard, for all we know. He surely would have had liaisons with the palace. He was a prince, even if only of our small tribe. What he did with those liaisons, how are we to say? But we don't think he died as the victim of a jealous husband. Maybe we're sheltered, but we don't. We think he got caught in the crossfire of some fringe struggle, or he was found out in the act of betrayal of one excitable group or other. He was a handsome man, said Two, and none of us would deny it, then or now. But he was intense and private, and we doubt he'd have loosened up enough to have an affair. By the smallest gesture, a sucking in of her abdomen and a squaring of her shoulders, Two betrayed the foundation of her position. How could he have succumbed to this Glinda's charms if he had been able to resist his own sisters-in-law?
But, Elfie asked in a small voice, do you really think he was a spy for someone?
Why was his body never found? Said Two. If it had been a jealous rage, his body needn't have been removed. Perhaps he hadn't died yet. Perhaps he was taken to be tortured. No, in our limited experience, we think that this smacks of treachery of a political stripe, not a romantic one.
I, said Elphaba.
You're pale, dear. Six, please, a beaker of water.
No, said Elphaba. It's just so one never thought at the time. I never. Shall I tell you what little I know of it? And perhaps you can mention it to Sarima? She began to pace. I saw Fiyero, but at the oddest possible moment, family solidarity kicked in.
Dear Auntie Guest, said Two in a responsible tone, we are under the strictest orders from our sister not to allow you to tire yourself by chatting about Fiyero and the sad circumstances of his death. Clearly, two had to work to get this out, as the appetite to hear what Elphaba had to say was huge. Stomachs were rumbling for the meat of it. But propriety won out, or fear of Sarima's wrath, if she were to find out.
"No," said Two again. "No, I'm afraid we mustn't express undue interest. We may not listen, and we will not tell Sarima what we hear."
In the end, Elphaba left them, drooping. "Another time," she kept saying. "When you're ready, when she's ready. You see, it's essential. There's so much grief she could be released from, and that she herself could lift, too."
"Goodbye for now," they said,
and the door closed behind her. The fires in the twin fireplaces mirrored back and forth across the room, and they took up positions of frustrated worthiness at having to obey their older sister. Curse her to hell. Ice crusted the roofs, dislodged tiles, and dripped dirtily into the private chambers, the music room, the towers. Elphaba took to wearing her hat indoors to avoid the random icy dart on her scalp. The crows were mildewy around the beak and had algae between the claws. The sisters finished their novel and collectively sighed, "For life, for life," and began to read it again, as they had done for 8 years. In the fierce updraft from the valley, the snow seemed as often to be rising as falling. The children adored it. One glum afternoon, Sarima bedecked herself in red woolen wraps and, out of boredom, went wandering through musty, disused rooms. She located a staircase in a trapezoidal slanting shaft. Perhaps this high alcove leaned against the side of the gable you couldn't see. She wasn't good at imagining architecture in three dimensions. She mounted the stairs anyway. At the top, through a crude grillwork, she saw a figure in the white gloom. Sarima coughed so as not to startle her. Elphaba was bent almost double over a huge folio laid out on a carpenter's workbench. She turned, surprised but not very, and said, "We've had the same inclination. How curious."
"You've found some books. I'd completely forgotten," said Sarima.
She could read now, but not well, and books made her feel inferior.
"I couldn't tell you what they're all about. So many words, you'd hardly think the world deserved such scrutiny."
"Over here is an archaic geography," said Elphi, "and some records of usufruct pact. Among various families of the Arjiki. I bet there are leaders who would be very happy to see these, unless they're outdated. Some texts that Fiero had in Shiz, I recognize them too, the life sciences course of studies."
"And this big thing, purple pages and silver ink, how grand."
"I found it on the floor of this wardrobe. It seems to be a grimoire," Elphi said, running her hand down a page, only softly buckled with moisture. It made a pretty contrast, her hand on the vellum.
"What is that, besides beautiful?"
"As I understand it," Elphi said, "a sort of encyclopedia of things numinous. Magic, and of the spirit world, and of things seen and unseen, and of things once and future. I can only make out a line here or there. Look how it scrambles itself as you watch." She pointed to a paragraph of hand-lettered text. Sarima peered. Though her skill at reading was minimal, she gaped at what she saw. The letters floated and rearranged themselves on the page, as if enlivened. The page was changing its mind as they watched it. The letters clotted together in a big black snarl, like a mound of ants. Then Elphaba turned a page. "Here, this section is a book of beasts." There were elegant, attenuated drawings in blood red and gold leaf on the front and rear elevations of, it seemed, an angel, with notes in a fine hand on the aerodynamic aspects of holiness. The wings flexed up and down, and the angel smiled with a saucy sort of sanctity. And a recipe on this page, it says, of apples with black skin and white flesh, to fill the stomach with greed unto death.
I remember this book now, Sarima said. I do remember how it came to be here. I even put it up here myself. I had forgotten.
Well, books are so easy to set aside, aren't they? Elfie looked up, her eyes leveling out under her smooth, rock-like brow.
Tell me, Sarima, please.
The Dowager Princess of Kiamo Ko was flustered. She went to a small window and tried to open it, but encrustations of ice prevented her. So she sat down in a flump on a packing crate and told Elphaba the story. She couldn't remember exactly when, but it was a long time ago when everyone was young and slim. Beloved Fiero was still alive, but he was off in the grasslands with the tribe. Complaining of a headache, she was home in the castle all alone. The bell at the drawbridge sounded, and she went to see who it was. "Madame Morrible," Elphaba said, "some Cumbric witch or other?"
No, it was no madam. It was an elderly man in a tunic and leggings, with a cloak badly in need of attention by a seamstress. He said he was a sorcerer, but perhaps he was just mad. He asked for a meal and a bath, which he got, and then he said he wanted to pay by giving me this book. I told him, with a castle to run, I didn't have much time for frivolity, reading and such. He said, never mind.
Sarima drew her robes about her and traced a pattern in the cold dust on a nearby stack of codices.
He told me a fabulous tale and persuaded me to take this thing from him. He said that it was a book of knowledge and that it belonged in another world, but it wasn't safe there. So he had brought it here, where it could be hidden and out of harm's way.
"What a load of tripe," said Elfie. "If it came from another world, I shouldn't be able to read any of it, and I can make out a little."
"Even if it's as magic as he says," said Sarima. "But, you know, I believed him. He said there was more congress between worlds than anyone would credit, that our world has attributes of his and his of ours, a kind of leakage effect, or an infection, maybe. He had a long, fringy white and gray beard, and a very kind and abstracted manner, and he smelled of garlic and sour cream.
Indisputable proof of otherworldliness."
"Don't mock me," said Sarima blandly. "You've asked me, so I'm telling you. He said it was too powerful to be destroyed, but too threatening to that other place to be preserved. So he made a magic trip or something and came here.
Kiamo Ko called to him, and he couldn't resist her attractions."
"He said we were isolated and a stronghold," said Sarima, "and I couldn't disagree. And what did it mean to me to take another book? We just lugged it up here and put it with the rest. I don't even know if I told anyone about it. Then he blessed me and left. He walked with an oak-thorn staff over the Loch Lim Trail."
"Can you really say you thought the man who brought this here was a sorcerer?" said Elfie. "And that this book comes from another world? Do you even believe in other worlds?"
"I find it a great effort to believe in this one," said Sarima. "Yet it seems to be here. So why should I trust my skepticism about other worlds? Don't you believe?"
"I tried to as a child," said Elfie. "I made an effort. The mothy, gomless, indistinct sunrise of Salvation World, the other land. I couldn't get it. I couldn't focus.
Now I just think it's our own lives that are hidden from us. The mystery. Who is that person in the mirror? That's shocking and unfathomable enough for me. Well, he was a very nice sorcerer, or madman, or whatever. Maybe it was some agent loyal to the Ozma Regent, said Elfie, secreting some ancient Lurlinus tract here, anticipating a revival of royalism, a palace coup, worried about the kidnapped, sleep-charmed Ozma Tipitarius coming in disguise to hide this document far away, but still retrievable. "You are full of conspiracy theories," said Sarima. "I've noticed that about you. This was an elderly gentleman, very elderly, and he spoke with an accent. He surely was a wandering magician from some other place. And hasn't he been right? The thing has sat here forgotten for, what, 10 years or more already. May I take it and look at it?" "I don't care. He never said not to read it," said Sarima. "At the time, I perhaps couldn't read at all, I forget. But look at that beautiful angel there. Do you really mean to say you don't believe in the other land? In an afterlife?" "Just what we need," Elphaba snorted as she picked up the tome. "A post-Vale of Tears, Vale of Tears." One morning, after Six had tried and given up once again at some sort of lessons for the children, Irgi suggested an indoor game of hide-and-seek. They drew straws, and Noor lost, so she hid her eyes and counted. When she got bored with waiting, she called out, 100, and looked about. She tagged Lear first. Though he liked to disappear alone for hours at a time, he was bad at hiding when it was required of him. So they hunted together for the older boys, and found Irgi in Sarima's solar, crouching behind the velvet ruffles suspended from the perch of a stuffed griffin. But Manic, the best at hiding, couldn't be found. Not in the kitchen, the music room, the towers. Running out of ideas, the children even dared to go down into the musty basement. "There's tunnels from here all the way to hell," said Irgi. "Where? Why?" said Noor, and Lear echoed. "They're hidden. I don't know where, but everybody says so. Ask Six. I think because this used to be a waterworks headquarters. It did. Hell burns so hot, they need water, and the devil's tunneled up to here." Noor said, "Look, Weir, here's the fish well." In the center of a low-vaulted room, damp with moisture beaded up on its stone walls, stood a low well with a wooden lid. There was a simple device with a chain and a stone for shifting the lid sideways. It was child's play to uncover the shaft. "Down there," said Irgi, "is where we get the fish we eat. Nobody knows if there's a whole lake down there, or if it's bottomless, or if you can go down right to hell." He moved the rushlight about, and there was a round of black water shining back a reflection in chips and circles of chilly white light. "Six says there's a gold carp in there," said Noor. "She saw it once. Biggest old thing. She thought it was a floating brass kettle bobbing to the surface. And then it turned and looked at her." "Maybe it was a brass kettle," said Lear. "Kettles don't have eyes," said Noor. "Anyway, Manic's not here," said Irgi. "Is he?" He called, "Hello, Manic!" And the echo rolled and dissolved in the wet dark. "Maybe Manic went down to hell in one of those tunnels," said Lear. Irgi swung the lid back on the fish well. "But you're it, Noor. I'm not going to look down here anymore." They gave themselves the creeps and raced back upstairs,
Four yelled at them for making too much noise. Nor found Manek at last on the stairs outside the door to Auntie Guest's rooms. "Shh," he said as they came near, and Nor tapped him anyway, saying, "You're out." "Shh," he said again, more urgently. They took turns looking through the crack in the weathered grain of the door. Auntie had her finger in a book, and she was mumbling things to herself, sounding them out this way and that. On the dresser next to her squatted Chistery in an uneasy, obedient silence.
"What's happening?" said Noor.
"She's trying to teach him to talk," said Manek.
"Let me look," said Lear.
"Say spirit," said Auntie in a kind voice. "Say spirit. Spirit. Spirit." Chistery twisted his mouth to one side, as if considering it. "There is no difference," said Auntie to herself, or maybe to Chistery. "The strands are the same, the skeins are the same, the rock remembers, the water has memory, the air has a past for which it can be held accountable, the flame renews itself like a phoenix. What is an animal but made of rock and water and fire and ether? Remember how to speak, Chistery. You are animal, but animal is your cousin, damn you. Say spirit." Chistery picked a nit off his chest and ate it. "Spirit," sang Auntie. "There is spirit, I know it. Spirit." "Spit," said Chistery, or something like it. Irgy shoved Manek aside, and the children almost fell through the door, trying to see Auntie laugh and dance and sing. She picked up Chistery and hugged him and said, "Spirit, oh, spirit, Chistery, there is spirit. Say spirit." "Spit, spit, spit," said Chistery, unimpressed with himself. "Spite." But Killyjoy woke from a nap at the sound of a new voice. "Spirit," said Auntie.
"Speared," said Chistery patiently. "Spared. Spored. Sput, sput, sput. Spat, spate, spit, speed, spurt, spot."
"Spirit," said Auntie. "Oh, my Chistery, we'll find ourselves a link with Dr. Dillamon's old work yet. There is a universal design among us all. Could we get in deeply enough to see? Everything is not in vain. Spirit, my friend, spirit."
"Sport," said Chistery.
The children couldn't stop laughing. They clattered down the stairs and fell into the dormitory and giggled into the bedclothes. They didn't mention what they saw to Sarima or the sisters. They were afraid Auntie would be stopped, and they all wanted Chistery to learn enough language so that he could play with them. One windless day, when it seemed they must get out of Kiamo Ko or expire of boredom, Sarima had the idea that they go skating on a nearby pond. The sisters agreed and dug out the rusting skates Fiero had brought back from the Emerald City.